This is a talk that is going to have a lot of information. Well, the way I've organized it, even though it says approach to migraine, I'm going to talk about headaches in general, try and differentiate different types of headaches, then move on to treatment of migraine, both from an abortive and a prophylactic standpoint. And finally, the last part of the talk is going to be a little bit about a workup of headaches and which patients we need to be concerned about with headaches. If you look at a problem of headaches, historically you should be able to ascertain from the patient a pretty good idea what type of headache you're dealing with. And from that standpoint, I try and put headaches into three large categories, fully appreciating that there's patients who have a mixed syndrome where they have a little of this and a little of that. But you have migraine cluster and muscle contraction headaches. And migraine typically is a unilateral headache. And I think that's one point that you can hang your head on. Typically, migraine is centered about the eye. The pain may be as high as the forehead, as low as the cheek, but it's very much a unilateral pain on one side of the head. Cluster is even more circumscribed behind the eye. A deep, boring pain in the eye, behind the eye, very much centered in the eye. And patients will sometimes say, if I could just take out my eyeball, my headaches would get better. Muscle tension, on the other hand, typically is hat band in distribution, pain in the temples, pain in the back of the neck, sort of hat band-ish, and bilateral as opposed to cluster and migraine, which is more unilateral. Now, appreciate that some patients may start their headache syndrome as a migraine and turn into a muscle contraction headache, and others may have a muscle contraction component that may get to be more migrainous as things go on. So the unilaterality of the headache is one point that is helpful. Migraine is typically a problem we see in a younger age group. It is very dangerous, certainly not unheard of, for migraine to present after age 40 as an event. It is not unusual for patients with migraine to have a history of headaches, preteen years, teenage years, and a quiescent period, and then pick up again. But it's not to say that you can't see migraine starting out after age 40, but when it does start out that late, you certainly have to consider other things. Cluster, on the other hand, typically starts out a little age group where migraine may be preteen, teen, 20s. Cluster starts out maybe as young as in the 20s, but more typically in 30 and 40-year-old patients. Muscle contraction pain, on the other hand, we see in adolescents, and we also see presenting in 45, 50, 55-year-old patients. So age is not as critical on the muscle contraction side. In terms of when the headache occurs during the day, migraine typically can occur at any time, sometimes in the daytime, sometimes in the evening. It may occur a couple times during the day. Cluster, on the other hand, for reasons we don't really understand, more typically occurs at nighttime, often waking the patient up. And again, patients may have several bouts of cluster during a 24-hour period. Muscle contraction pain can be seen after stressful situations, but I really want to de-emphasize stress as a real help in terms of helping you decide what sort of headache you're dealing with. A typical migrainer has 2 to 4 attacks per year. There are some migrainers that have 2 to 4 attacks per year. There are some that have 2 to 4 attacks per month, and there are others that have 2 to 4 attacks per week. But on average, a typical migrainer will have 2 to 4 attacks per month. Cluster falls into two categories. Two-thirds of the cluster patients have what we call a typical or episodic cluster, where they'll have a bout of headaches, an average bout maybe every 6 months to every year, year and a half, and an average headache bout may last from 4 to 8 weeks. And that represents two-thirds of the group. The other one-third of the group have a periodicity like we see in migraine, where they may have a couple headaches a week and really not this quiescent period that you see in a more classic cluster headache. Muscle contraction, more continuous, more insidious, can be there, and really doesn't have necessarily a headache-free period that migraine and cluster typically have. Now, when we say that a typical migrainer has 2 to 4 attacks per month, if you look at how that figure is arrived, what you see is that 60% of the migraine population has 1 to 12 attacks per year. So they may have one or a couple attacks per year. On the other hand, a quarter of them have 1 to 3 attacks per month. And as you can see, 10% approximately have one per week, and 18 have 2 to 6 per week. So when you average all that together, you get 3 to 4 attacks per month. But as you can see, you've got a variation ranging from 1 or 2 a year down to 1 or 2 a week. So there's nothing in terms of the frequency of the headache that helps you differentiate. Now, migraine is primarily a problem seen in young females, and I think that is something else that you can hang your hat on. 70% of the migraine population is female. When you're dealing with adolescents, you're probably closer to 50-50, but certainly in an adult population, the majority are female. Cluster, on the other hand, the majority of those patients are male, to a point that if we see a male with what we think a migraine is, we're not too concerned because 30% are male. But if we see a female that we think has cluster headaches, invariably that patient has to be worked up. But 10% are female. Muscle contraction pain, on the other hand, pretty much equal between males and females. A typical migraine attack lasts for 4 hours. Now, many here who treat migraine know that patients are disabled by their headache much longer than 4 hours. But if you talk to patients and you find out about their whole headache syndrome, which may begin as a prodrome, and then go through an aura, and then go through a period of head pain, and then go through a period of postdrome, and then go till they finish, that may be 36 hours where they feel lousy. But the actual period of head pain is more typically 4 to 10 hours. Cluster, on the other hand, fortunately because the headache is generally more severe, lasts for shorter periods of time. So there you might have a headache lasting 30 to 45 minutes, sometimes as long as 4 hours, but more typically 30 to 45 minutes. But not unusual to have several attacks during a 24-hour period. Muscle contraction pain, on the other hand, more continuous, more persistent, and doesn't have the periodicity that we see with migraine. Patients will tell you that equally disabling to them in terms of their headache, aside from the head pain, are the other things that come with the headache. And when we talk about treatment of those sorts of problems, we have to address the nausea and vomiting, the photophobia that comes with a headache, as well as the head pain. Now let's talk about nausea and vomiting a little bit, because there are some things to keep in mind. Point one, 90% of patients with headaches, for whatever reason, have nausea with their headache. So the fact that a patient has nausea with their headache doesn't tip you to migraine. Now, I think most patients and most physicians think that if you're nauseous with your headache, that you have migraine. If you get a story of copious vomiting with the headache where you can't keep anything down, that clearly tips you towards migraine. Likewise, photophobia. Most patients with headaches, for whatever reason, struggle with bright lights. Okay, but if you get a story where a patient goes in a dark room, turns off the lights, doesn't want to deal with anything, real photophobia, that tips you towards migraine. On the cluster side, we typically can see lacrimation, rhinorrhea, facial flushing on the side of the head pain. So in the cluster patients, you have a middle-aged male, deep boring pain behind the eye. There may be tearing of that eye, running of the nose on that side, maybe some redness of the eyes, maybe a little pupillary difference, ptosis on that side. That's a typical story that you'll see with cluster. With our muscle contraction patients, aside from the band-like head pain they have, there you have to think about neck pain, tenderness in the occipital nerve exit zone, and pain back here. And a lot of those patients will benefit, aside from medication, from physical therapy, occipital nerve decompression, lots of different things that go along with the muscle contraction pain. Now, let's talk a little bit about precipitating factors, because I think some of those are overrated. Let's first talk about diet, because sort of diet has carried through over the years as a major precipitant for migraine. When things have been looked at scientifically at different foods, whether it's bologna, salami, smoked meats, chocolate, strawberries, whatever you hear, the only food that has clearly been associated with an increased risk of migraine is red wine. Okay, that's it. So that means that I can find you as many articles that say that chocolate brings on a headache as I can show you articles where they fed migraineurs chocolate and there was no increased risk. That's when you take the group as a whole. For an individual patient, there's no question that certain foods may precipitate a patient headache. So that means when you're talking to the patient about foods, what I tell them is not to arbitrarily eliminate foods from your diet unless there are certain foods that you know will precipitate a headache, other than red wine. Red wine is the only thing that I will tell patients to stay off of with their headaches. Hormonal changes, menstruation. I would say that menstrual-related migraine certainly is a problem. I would say that 90% of women who have headaches will find that their headaches exacerbate during their cycle. But that's a different figure than those that only have migraine with their cycle. In those patients that only have migraine with their cycle, there are certain things that we can do to sort of tailor treatment during their cycle, and if they're taking a birth control pill, during the period leading up to their cycle. Because there are some longer-acting triptans that I'll talk about in a minute, which we use prophylactically as opposed to just use when a headache is starting in those patients with menstrual migraine. Generally speaking, if a patient is on birth control pills, we will try and change the birth control pill one time to a different pill. That is the OBGYN. My experience is changing the pill only helps 20% of the patients. One of the good things that happens with pregnancy is the majority of migraineurs who see a change will find that their headaches improve during pregnancy. And that's helpful because the drugs that we can use during pregnancy are much, much more limited. So we recommend in pregnancy that patients take fewer medicines, but on the other hand, we find that headaches improve during pregnancy. Likewise, when women go through menopause and get through menopause, probably only 10% of migraineurs that have headaches premenopausal will find that they're still troubled by headaches when they go through menopause. On the cluster side, certain medications, here we're talking about alcohol and vasodilators, may precipitate a cluster headache. That's not to say that it precipitates a full 4 to 8 week period of headaches, but it will precipitate a cluster. Now, I'm going to quickly go through treatment now in a general sense and then get specific here. If you look at what is used for migraine, it's really sort of a little disconcerting, even in this day and age. These are the things that patients and doctors use to treat migraine. And you see that about a quarter get a prescription medication, about 50% use OTC medicines only, another quarter will use a combination, and about 5% use no medication. So even with all the education we've done for physicians, all the advertisement that's on TV, still about a half of patients get a prescription medicine, and another half are still only using over-the-counter medication. When you talk about migraine medications, you have simple analgesics here, and here you're talking about Tylenol, aspirin, non-steroidals, antiemetics, ergots, which certainly in this day and age are being used less frequent, and finally the triptans. And the triptans really are the backbone of abortive therapy in this day and age. Just going through categories of medicines that are used for acute migraine medication, and we're going to begin by talking for something you can take for a individual headache once it's started. We have the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the triptans, and we'll go through each one of those in a minute to just sort of talk about those. Combination analgesics, here we're talking about Fiorcet, Frenolin, Estric, Midrin, which are combinations of aspirin, Tylenol, with or without a muscle relaxant, with or without caffeine. And finally, narcotic analgesics. Let's just touch base on narcotic analgesics for a minute so I can deal with that. The only time where narcotic analgesics are the drug of choice, and are clearly the drug of choice, is with pregnancy. The safest medicine to use in a migraineur who's pregnant is codeine. After you get away from Tylenol on a PRN basis, then the next thing I will use is Tylenol with codeine. And that's the only time that we'll use narcotics on a regular basis. Now, that's not to say that some patients aren't taking Vicodin or Tylenol 3, Tylenol 4 with their headaches, but that's the only time that I would strongly recommend that you consider use of a narcotic analgesic. All the other medicines that I'm going to mention, every single one, whether it's the triptans, whether it's beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, are not medicines that I'd recommend on a regular basis during pregnancy. So I tell patients that there's basically three things we can use: Tylenol, Tylenol with codeine, and sometimes I'll use a little bit of a drug like Frenolin, which is Butalbital, and Tylenol, and without caffeine. And those are sort of the three things that I'll use. And most migraineurs, especially if you can get them through the first trimester, which is the time you really want to be especially careful about what you use, most patients, because as I told you, most migraineurs will see that there is some improvement during pregnancy anyway, will get through that way. There are currently five, now seven triptans on the market, okay? And the first thing I will tell you about the triptans, and I'm sure in this room most everybody has some experience with triptans if you see anybody with headaches. There are seven available. There is sumatriptan, which is Imitrex, zolmitriptan, which is Zomig, naritriptan, which is Emerge, rizatriptan, which is Maxalt, amlotriptan, which is Axert, and since there's elitriptan, which is Relpax, and finally frovatriptan, which is Frova. Okay, so there's seven of them out there. The first thing I tell you is that the drugs are more similar than they are different. Okay, they all work. Despite what the drug companies may come and tell you, they all work well. There is clearly a difference in them in terms of how they are presented to the patient. So in the case of Imitrex, you have a shot, you have a nasal spray, and you have a swallow pill. With Zomig, you have a nasal spray, you have a dispersible tablet, and a swallow pill. Emerge is a swallow pill. Rizatriptan, Maxalt is a swallow pill and a dispersible tablet on the tongue. Amlotriptan Axert is a drug that's only available as a swallow pill. Relpax is a swallow pill, and Frova is a swallow pill. So some patients would prefer taking a nasal spray. Some patients would prefer something that dissolves on the tongue. Imitrex injectable is the only available shot for migraine. So that's one thing that distinguishes these things. The other thing that sort of distinguishes them, there it is somewhat helpful to you, is the Tmax, and at the same time the T1/2. This is how fast the drugs work. The fastest acting drug we have is a shot of Imitrex. And if you look at the data on where the 50th percentile responds, that is, if you take all the patients who respond to Imitrex, where the 50th percentile is for those that respond with a shot of Imitrex is about 30 to 45 minutes. Okay? That's on the one side. On the other side, the slowest of all the response is Emerge, where that 50th percentile is somewhere at 4 to 5 hours. So we use those to our advantage, both the ones that come on slowly and the ones that act quickly. For those patients that have a protracted aura and don't and have a period before they actually get their headache, you can use something that comes on slower. In those patients that typically have a recurrence of their headache, so they get a headache, it gets treated, and then 2, 3 hours, 4 hours later, they get another headache, and they have a recurrence of headache, you can use a longer-acting triptan. In those patients who need something that comes on quickly, then a shot of Imitrex is the fastest thing you have. The second fastest thing you have is a nasal spray of Zomig. The rest of these things, Zomig, Imitrex by mouth, rizatriptan, and amlotriptan, these are all sort of what I would call intermediate drugs. They sort of come on 1.5 to 2.5 hours in terms of their 50% efficacy. So the speed of onset is another thing that differentiates how you choose one of these medications. And those are really the two things that I use. The other things in terms of, I have some data on efficacy. I'm not sure I want to go through it because I've sort of have hit the high points in terms of those things. This is just looking at efficacy pain-free in 2 hours, and you can see that it ranges from 20 to 30% are pain-free at 2 hours. Adverse events is the other thing to just talk about. There are three absolute contraindications to using triptans in general, and I think if you adhere to these, you won't get in trouble. One is coronary artery disease. Now, in a population that's primarily young and female, that's usually not an issue, but certainly something to consider. Hypertension, second thing. So if there is a history of hypertension, then you have to think twice about triptans. Now, I'm always asked about how about treated hypertension. Patients who have hypertension, they're in the office, their blood pressure is okay, then I think you can use a triptan. The third thing, which I think is very germane, is focal neurologic deficit as part of the aura. Okay? About a third of migraineurs will have an aura before they have the head pain. Now, I differentiate aura from prodrome. Prodrome is the non-specific thing that migraineurs can have, queasiness in their stomach, zigzag things. Just they sort of know that their headache's going to come on. An aura is an actual frank neurologic dysfunction. So they may have weakness on one side. They may have blindness in the eye. They may have numbness and tingling on one side, where they have really focal neurologic deficit. If you find that the patients have focal neurologic deficits, then you do not want to use a triptan. Okay, absolutely. So, focal neurologic deficit, hypertension, coronary artery disease. Those are the three places you can't use triptans. I can tell you with the support of cardiologists and internists who I see patients for, I have gentlemen in their 70s that I'm treating with triptans. I'm a little nervous about it, but I probably have a dozen of them now without history of coronary artery disease, without history of hypertension, and knock on wood, we've done fine. So these are just some slides that sort of looks at the side effect profile of these drugs. I think I'll summarize it with this slide, where if you look at efficacy in the arrow going up and tolerability with the arrow going down, it sort of breaks the drugs down. In my experience, and again, it's only anecdotal from mine, but I see lots of different people. Axert is probably the drug that is best tolerated in terms of side effects. A lot of patients, when the drugs came out, and I'm sure you've all heard it, will complain of some fullness in the throat, sort of a choking feeling in the throat. It was especially prominent with a shot of Imitrex. With the oral pills, it isn't as prominent, but that is almost seen with Imitrex. As we move to some of the newer triptans, that complaint is not as prevalent. But on the other hand, probably 60% of the patients who are on triptans are on Imitrex. So I'm not telling you that Imitrex is not a safe drug, but that complaint of fullness in the throat is something that we see more commonly with Imitrex. So I think, and this study which sort of made an attempt to look at these different things. Now, the thing when you look at a slide like this is to remember that these drugs were not compared one to another, okay? Every one of the drugs was compared to Imitrex. In order to get approved by the FDA, the gold standard is 100 milligram tablet of Imitrex. So you had to look at chest pain versus Imitrex, and then they sort of plotted it out. So it's not as if they compared amitriptan to elitriptan. They sort of looked at them all in terms of side effects versus Imitrex. So in general, the side effects can be some tingling, paresthesia, warmth, dizziness, flushing, some chest discomfort. When the drug was introduced in 1991, we did cardiograms before we gave a first dose of Imitrex. Now I would say that is not the case. The contraindications, as I've mentioned, pregnancy I didn't specifically mention, but I mentioned to you that really we don't use anything other than the drugs I mentioned. So pregnancy, ischemic heart disease, hemiplegic, basilar migraine, those are the things that I talked about, focal neurologic deficits. Those are the real contraindications. And the triptans are really the backbone of abortive therapy. Okay? Now, abortive therapy is still only, with these drugs, 30% of what is used. Most patients are still using over-the-counter medications, whether it's Tylenol, aspirin, Excedrin migraine, which is Tylenol, aspirin, and caffeine. The other things certainly are used, simple analgesic, the Estrics, the Frenulins. The thing you have to remember with anything that has a lot of Tylenol and aspirin is analgesic rebound headache. and that's a real entity that all of us deal with, and that is patients who take too much Tylenol and aspirin can have a headache brought on by all that Tylenol and aspirin. So we really want to be careful about that. Now, how about the with the triptans, the sort of amount that I'll allow patients to use? Now, keep in mind that drug companies really dictate to a lot of patients how many they can use. And I have many drug companies that will, insurance companies that will only allow patients four triptans a month. I have others that will give many more. My instructions are three per headache, as long as each dose is separated by 3 hours, three per headache, nine per week, 36 per month. Now, that's a lot of triptan. 36 per month translates to one a day. And certainly, if a patient is taking that much of a triptan, you need to think about putting them on a prophylactic agent as well as an abortive agent. But from a safety standpoint, if you've cleared those things that I've mentioned, there's no problem using a fair amount of triptan. And, you know, expense is certainly a consideration. But we are fairly liberal in the amount of triptan we'll allow most patients. Then the next thing to discuss is, when do we think about a prophylactic agent and what is currently available on the prophylactic side? There's no hard and fast rule about who needs to go on a prophylactic agent. And keep in mind that many patients can take both a prophylactic agent and an abortive agent, a triptan, for a breakthrough headache. So it's not as if you have to choose either or as the approach. You can put a patient on a daily agent, and then if they have a breakthrough headache, you can let them take their triptan to treat an individual headache. Really, it comes down to, A, how disabled the patient is by the frequency of the headache, and B, if triptans are contraindicated, it really eliminates a lot of the medicine you can give a patient on the abortive side. There's no hard and fast rule, but if a patient has 3 to 4 headaches per month on a regular basis, you need to think about a prophylactic agent. Now, I have some patients who have 3 to 4 headaches a week and don't want to go on a prophylactic agent. I have some that have 3 to 4 headaches a year and want to go on a daily medicine just for those 3 to 4 bad headaches. So you can't be actually dogmatic about who needs to go on a prophylactic agent. But if the patient is missing work, missing school, and their lives are affected by their headaches, if the headaches have become a focal point of the family or the patient, you need to think of a prophylactic agent. And practically speaking, if a headache is there once a week on a pretty regular basis, you need to think about a daily medication. Also, if a patient has hemiplegic migraine, all these things that were contraindicated on the abortive side with the triptans, you're sort of forced into a prophylactic agent because you can't use the abortive agent. As simple as it seems, when you want to start a prophylactic agent, you have to start a medication low and build it up. Now, that makes sense, but I can't tell you how many patients I see that get started on 750 milligrams of Depakote or 100 milligrams of Elavil at night. I mean, if you're going to treat a patient with a prophylactic agent, you want to start slowly. I think a general rule which holds in any medication group that you choose, whether it's beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, or anticonvulsants, and we'll touch on all of those, is on average you can usually get away with half of the dose that you think about for the primary other condition you might be treating. So for seizures, we might use Depakote at 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams. Our average dose when we looked at our first 70 patients on Depakote for migraine was 640 milligrams. For calcium channel blockers, we see response at 100 and 200 milligrams of isoptin, where for hypertension, you might use twice as much of that. For Topamax, an average dose for seizure control might be 300 milligrams. For migraine, we see good efficacy at 100 or 125, 150 milligrams. So you want to start slowly, A, to avoid the side effects, but B, because you may find efficacy at a dose much less than you would be treating other conditions. You want to convince the patient, and it's often difficult, that they need to be on the medicine at least a month before you abandon the medicine. You know, typically patients come in, you put them on a medication, a week later you get a call, I still have my headaches, what am I going to do? And right away the doctor changes to another medicine. Before you know, they've been treated for 6 weeks and they've been on four different medications. And that's sometimes tough because the patients will force your hand. But you sort of have to at least try and get a month, sometimes 2 months on a medicine, trying to build the dose up before you abandon the medicine. I've talked a little bit about overuse medication. Another thing that's helpful, and I appreciate that everyone is not a neurologist in the crowd, but if you can get a patient to at least keep track of their headaches in a general sense, what we give them is an actual calendar where they don't fill in every day, but they fill in the days they have a bad headache, at least you have a sense of how the patient's doing. Because if not, they're going to come in 2 weeks, a month, two later, and they say, yeah, I think my headaches are better, I think my headache's worse, and you really don't have a feel for whether that's true or not. But if you can get them to fill out a calendar in a general sense and keep track of their headaches, at least you have a chance to see if your therapy is working. Now, let's talk about the different drugs that have been used in migraine to sort of give you an idea of where we've come from. Methysergide, Sansert, was the first drug that was used in 1962 and currently really is a third-line agent. And it was really only used now in those patients who sort of failed a lot of other things. In 1979, propranolol, beta blocker, was used in migraine. In 88, sort of the criteria were established that sort of helped us differentiate headaches. Another beta blocker in 1990. Depakote in 1996, the extended-release Depakote in 2000, and topiramate in 2004. So those are sort of the different drug groups that were used in treatment of migraine. I should throw in 1972 when tricyclic antidepressant amitriptyline Elavil was used in migraine. Interestingly, you can add Topamax now, 2004. These are the only drugs that have ever been approved by the FDA for migraine. So everybody, we use lots of different stuff. This is on the prophylactic side. Certainly all the triptans that I referred to have been approved for migraine. But in terms of all these other things, Elavil's never been approved. Midrin has never been approved for migraine. This is it in terms of what have been approved for migraine. That's not to say we shouldn't use other things, but these are the drugs that have been approved. Let me first give you a general overview on the different classes of medicines that have been used in migraine. Certainly today, the most exciting and the most frequently used drugs in migraine prophylaxis are the anticonvulsants. Okay, with valproate, Depakote, gabapentin, Neurontin, and topiramate, Topamax, as the drugs in that group that have been used most frequently. And valproate and topiramate have been approved for migraine. Gabapentin will never be approved because it's now generic, and the drug company that had it never pushed studies for it. Antidepressants, tricyclic antidepressants, here we're talking primarily about amitriptyline, Elavil, nortriptyline, have been used. The SSRIs are better in terms of side effects, but worse in terms of efficacy in migraine. So the SSRIs are not being used all that much, except for Cymbalta, a new antidepressant, which I'm starting to use in migraine. It's a nicer drug in terms of side effects, and thus far I have been reasonably pleased with the response, but again, this is not a drug that has been approved for migraine. Certainly, amongst the beta blockers, propranolol is the drug that's been used most frequently. On the calcium channel side, verapamil and methysergide, as I've mentioned, is sort of a second-line agent. Nonsteroidals and some other ancillary treatments other than what we've listed. Now, the goal of the preventive therapy sort of makes sense. Reduce the frequency of the headache, reduce the severity of the headache, and perhaps make the patient a little more success in terms of their acute treatment with triptans. Now, I've already touched on the lower dose, and that's something that you can take away. increase the dose slowly, and be sure you use an adequate trial before you abandon the medicine. Now, when we sort of look in a global sense as to how do we decide which one of these prophylactic agents to start, I would say that about a third of the time, your choice is based on something else that you can help the patient with. Okay? Whether it's a depression, which is often the case, where you might choose to use an antidepressant. Patients having trouble sleeping at night, so you might choose to use an antidepressant. Patient may have a seizure disorder. You might use one of the anticonvulsants. A young woman may have prolapsed mitral valve and tachycardia, so you might use a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker. So a third of the time, hypertension, another thing in males who have migraine, you might use a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker. So a third of the time, you have another disease that you're treating, and that helps you decide. But about two-thirds of the time, you sort of have to sort of jump in and decide where you're going to start medication. I would say in today's day, the anticonvulsants are the place that I start most frequently. And certainly amongst those groups, Topamax is the drug that is used most frequently. Just a brief note on quality of evidence, scientific effect, and clinical impression. And sort of what this is an attempt to look at the literature, trying to decide what's the evidence in the literature that the drug works, is there a scientific basis, and what's the general clinical impression on how these things work. So what you'd like to be is four stars. And this just goes through that. The quality of evidence doesn't trouble me that much, because what you're really more interested in is does it work, and likewise the scientific effect is not all that troubling in terms of whether or not you choose to use a medicine. Let me then go quickly and talk about each one of these so that you've heard about each one and how the best way to use them. Amongst the anti-epileptics, I mentioned topiramate. Topamax is the drug we start out first. Topamax has two major side effects, none of which are serious. One is it makes patients very sleepy, and there's always now a syndrome that we refer to as almost a dumbing down, where patients get concentration problems and really can't function, but that's about 1 in 20. The other side effect is numbness and tingling in the fingers, and that occurs in 1 in 10, so that's pretty common. The numbness and tingling invariably goes away, and in most patients, the sleepiness will go away, but if they get that concentration problem, it's really hard to deal with, and we've had to stop the medicine. With Topamax, you want to start at a 25 milligram dose at night, and then every week increase by 25. 25 at night for the first week, 25 in the morning, 25 at night for the second week, 25 in the morning, 50 at night for the third week, and then 50-50. You try and get to a dose of 150. Sometimes you can, if you get to a dose of 100, you can get efficacy there. So that's Topamax. Start slowly, build it up slowly, be aware of the numbness and tingling. Now, there also are some other things that were kidney stones and some eye problems that occur rarely, but the biggest issues are the sleepiness and the numbness and tingling in the fingers. With Depakote, we always use the extended-release tablet, starting out at 250 milligrams at night, and every 2 weeks, increase by 250 milligrams to, say, 500 milligrams at night for the fourth, third, and fourth week. And sometimes if you get efficacy at 500 milligrams, you stop there. Sometimes you have to go to 750 milligrams or even to a gram. If you get to a gram and you're not getting decent results there, then you really don't want to push the drug any further. The big side effects with Depakote are three, alopecia, weight gain, and a fine tremor. The alopecia is rarely a problem, but it does occur. The fine tremor is almost always seen, and if you reassure the patient that the tremor goes away and it's really not too much of a problem, the weight gain is a real problem. The nice thing about Topamax that I mentioned to you first is that the drug is weight neutral or has weight loss as a side effect. So a lot of patients, when the drug first came out, were coming and saying, give me that new migraine medicine that'll make me lose weight. So Topamax has that advantage. Gabapentin, Neurontin, is a drug that we use in the migraine. There we started out typically at a dose of 100 milligrams BID, increase it quickly to 100 milligrams in the morning, 300 milligrams at night, then 300 BID, then 300, 600, and then 600 BID. So I've gone through that quickly. But basically, you go from 200 to 1,200 over maybe a six-week period. So every week, you pick up the dose. Now, some patients, you can go faster than that. But to try and minimize the side effects, I try and go slower. So those are the three anticonvulsants. So that I've touched on other things, the newer anticonvulsants that are around, like Keppra, were Lamictal. These are newer seizure medicines we're looking at in migraine. But these are the three that we're using primarily. On the antidepressant side, certainly Elavil is the drug that's used most frequently. Here the big problems are weight gain, sleepiness, and then anticholinergic issues of trouble urinating, defecating. So you have to build it up slowly. You want to start Elavil as an HS dosing, something like 25 at night for a week, then 50 at night for a week, then 25 in the morning, 50 at night, 25 in the morning, 75 at night, where you give the majority of the dose at night. Now, Elavil also has weight gain associated with it. I'm sure most in this room have used Elavil. Generally, if I get to 100 milligrams and I haven't gotten efficacy on the side of the headache, then I won't push the drug any further. The newer SSRIs like Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft are better as antidepressants than they are in treatment of migraine. And I would say we have very little success in treatment of migraine. I mentioned Cymbalta, a newer antidepressant. Here we've had decent luck. We started with 30 milligrams at night for a week and then quickly move up to 60 milligrams at night. You can go as high as 120 milligrams, but again, I try and get to 60 milligrams and see if I get efficacy. And if I do, I leave it at that. Sometimes I'll go up to 90 or 120. But usually if we get to 60 and we don't see much effect. And there I'll wait maybe 2 weeks before increasing the dose from 30 to 60 and then wait a couple more weeks to see if we get some success. On the beta blocker side, certainly propranolol is a drug that's used most frequently. I don't like using beta blockers in women because of exercise intolerance, alopecia, depression. So I almost exclusively use beta blockers in males with migraine. I usually start at a fairly low dose, 80 milligrams long-acting, really push the medicine till we get a pulse down to 60 and a blood pressure of 90 over 60. Once we get the pulse down to 60 and the blood pressure drops to 90 over 60, then I won't push the beta blocker any further. Rarely will you use a different beta blocker like timolol or atenolol, but almost everybody who's on a beta blocker in my practice is male and is using propranolol. On the calcium channel blocker side, verapamil is clearly the drug that we use most frequently. It's also an extended release drug. Usually we use the same sort of framework, move the medicine till we get a pulse of 60 and a blood pressure of 90 over 60. Here we'll start at 100 milligrams, then go to 200 milligrams, 300 milligrams, sometimes as high as 540 milligrams. Again, because the population is primarily young, healthy, pushing the medicine is really not an issue. The biggest problem with verapamil, as you know, is constipation and a little bit of exercise intolerance, but not as much as we see with the beta blockers. In terms of those other drugs, let me just touch on a couple just so you've heard of it. Cyproheptadine is a drug that is sort of an interesting drug. It's a drug that, periactin, it's a drug that's pretty good in childhood migraine. It is an appetite generator, stimulant, so it's a bugaboo in terms of some patients gaining weight. It's also very soporific. So there I use, the only time I really use periactin on a regular basis is in those cluster patients who have a lot of rhinorrhea and lacrimation as part of that cluster syndrome. So if they have a lot of that, then I use the antihistamine part of the cyproheptadine. Or I'll sometimes use it in childhood migraine in teenagers using a liquid, 2 milligrams, 4 milligrams. Something to keep in mind, especially with cluster patients. methysergide because of the complications of retroperitoneal cardiac and pulmonary fibrosis is really a third-line drug. Patients have to go on a drug holiday every time they go on the medication, so you have to put them on for 6 months, take them off for a month, put them on for 6 months. Really, there we use it sort of if a lot of these other things have failed. There are still certainly patients who respond to Sansert, but because of the issues on drug holiday and things, you really should consider that as sort of a third-line agent. Let me just touch on two other things so that you've heard about most everything that we use. One are steroids. When I trained, no one talked to me about use of steroids in migraine. I have found it very helpful, especially in those cluster patients who are in a cluster. If I use steroids, I use them one of two ways. I either use them in a three-day quick tapering dose, 60 milligrams the first day, 40 milligrams the next, 20 milligrams the next with prednisone. Or in our cluster patients who are in the midst of one of those clusters, I use something like 60 milligrams the first week, 40 to 20 taper the second week, 20 to 0 taper the third week. So I'll try and keep them on for all 3 weeks. I'll also use Topamax. I may also use Verapamil. I may also use Periactin. I may also use oxygen therapy. So with our cluster patients, we really have lots that we can try, and frankly, we're not all that successful. Triptans also are useful in cluster patients, but if they're getting 2 to 3 headaches a night, you know, using that much triptan from a cost standpoint and from a safety standpoint, it's hard to. But their oxygen will sometimes help those patients. Let me just skip ahead. These are just studies that I don't want to really touch on. Let's just touch on some of these non-pharmacological therapies so I can just give me my thoughts on them. I am open-minded in anything that patients come to me with. So there are some patients who want to do biofeedback. There are some patients who want to do acupuncture, transcutaneous nerve stimulation, biofeedback, et cetera. A lot of it, I haven't found all that helpful. Most of the time, we use either physical therapy or medication approach. One of the things I just want to talk to you about, which I think is something to bring up, is occipital nerve block and occipital nerve decompression. A lot of our muscle contraction patients, but also a lot of our patients with migraine, will have tenderness in the posterior strap muscles back here. There is now data, and we have found with several of our patients, Norman Rappaport and myself have taken a group of patients, and we're treating them with Botox first, and if they respond to Botox, then we are thinking about decompressing the occipital nerve on this side, and in some patients, we're giving Botox in the corrugator muscle here, and if they respond there, then Norman will do a decompressive procedure endoscopically here. So there are some patients that we say in for occipital nerve block. There are others that we sell for occipital nerve treatment of Botox, and then a surgery to clean up the nerve here, akin to what you would do with a carpal tunnel here. The tip-off is if they're exquisitely tender in the exit point of the occipital nerve. And what you want to find is a little bit of difference on one side or the other, because almost everybody, if you mash around in here where the occipital nerve exits, they're going to be a little tender. But if you see an asymmetry on both sides and they get pain that shoots up from that stimulation, you might consider an occipital nerve block. I touched on Botox. Botox is really a plus-minus thing in headaches, frankly. There's a group in Cleveland that reported that they help 95% of their migraineurs with Botox injection in the corrugator muscle here and several other. Norman and I have done 13 patients with Botox. You know, I think we are reasonably satisfied that in about half of them we thought the Botox helped, and then if the Botox helps, then we give them the option instead of doing the Botox every 3 or 4 months, which is what you have to do with Botox, then you might do a surgical procedure of cutting the corrugator muscle, taking pressure off of a nerve here, or doing a procedure here, as I mentioned. So that just sort of touches on some of the other approaches other than medication. I just want to talk a little bit about an approach to headache in terms of a non-neurologist approach and basically answer the question of who you have to worry about with a headache. Okay? The first thing from a reassurance standpoint, the likelihood of a patient presenting to you well-dressed, with a normal neurologic examination, a normal mentation, having something serious in their head is virtually zero. It's not zero, but it's virtually zero. The buzzwords that you can take out is you want to work up the first and the worst headache. So if a patient tells you this is the worst headache I've had in my life, you have to sort of think about it. If the patient tells you this is the first time I've had headaches, okay, now if they're a 22-year-old female and the story is pretty suggestive of migraine as I've mentioned it to you, then you might not want to work up that patient. But anytime it's the first or the worst headache in their life, you at least have to pay attention. The other thing you want to do, and I think not everybody's going to do a thorough neurologic examination, but the two things you got to do if you're going to quickly determine whether or not you're going to worry about the headache is A, look in their eyes, a fundoscopic examination. And the other thing you can do, and I think the best thing to do, and sort of taught by my boss here for many, many years, is have the patient walk. It's not hard to have the patient walk. If a patient can walk backwards and forwards, can walk on their heels, can walk on their toes, can turn perfectly well, then the likelihood that they're going to have a significant abnormality on their neurologic examination is pretty remote. That's not to say they can't have papilledema. That's not to say they can't have double vision. But the odds of them having a hemiplegia, spasticity, those sorts of things, if they're walking and turning completely well, is pretty remote. So if you're going to do anything, you look in their eyes and you have the patient walk backwards and forwards. I'm not telling you shouldn't do a neurologic examination, but I'm practical on what you can do. So if their examination is normal and their headache makes sense, okay, they're a migraineur who's a 25-year-old female and not a migraineur who's a 60-year-old male. If they're a cluster patient who's a male and not a cluster patient who's a female. So if the exam is okay and the story makes sense, then you go ahead and treat the patient and not have to worry about working that patient up. If you're going to work up the patient, there's basically only two things you got to decide. And that is who needs a spinal tap and who needs an imaging study. Okay? In terms of a headache and whether or not there's anything serious going on, a non-contrasted CAT scan, simple, 2 minutes in the machine, in and out, can answer 95% of your questions. It can answer if there's a subarachnoid hemorrhage. It can answer if there's a shift to the midline. It can answer if there's a mass in the head. It can answer if there's blood in the ventricles. So a simple non-contrasted CAT scan is enough to quickly answer the question, do I have something serious? And everybody can tolerate a non-contrasted CAT scan. I mean, it's literally 1 minute. You have to tap those patients. You have to also scan those patients who you're going to do a spinal tap on. So if you're going to tap the patient for a problem of headaches, you need to scan the patient first. Okay? So you scan the patients whose histories don't make sense, whose exams are abnormal, or you're thinking of doing a spinal fluid examination as part of their workup. That's who needs to be scanned. The only ones who need to be tapped are those patients who have some sort of viremia, a stiff neck, something that tips you off that you may be dealing either with a subarachnoid hemorrhage or an infection. Now, this is a part of the country that we see a lot of viral encephalitis. Usually, if a patient has a bacterial meningitis, they're going to be very sick, and you're not going to miss that. What you're going to see a lot of is viral encephalitis. And a lot of patients who come in with 102 fevers, sort of achy, stiff neck, you give them some medication, and then they go home. 3 days later, they're feeling better. If you had tapped that patient at that time, a lot of those patients would have a pleocytosis, you know, a mild elevation of the white cell count, viral, sort of self-limiting, and goes away. You know, in terms of an EEG, blood work, you know, yes, we think about temporal arteritis in a middle-aged elderly patient who has some tenderness in the temporal artery, but you're not going to see that much temporal arteritis. What you're really worried about is what shouldn't I miss and who should I scan? So it is 6 o'clock. Thank you very much.